hearing about frontiers in neuroscience. Our first speaker is Peter Clark. He's associate professor in the Department of Cell Biology and Morphology at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. And his talk to us today is entitled Determinism and Free Will.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So my topic is determinism and free will. Thank you very much for inviting me. For many of you, I'm delighted to be here. And I would like it would be good to give a brief explanation of where I come from, who I am. So I'm English. This is really temporary. I'm sorry. Maybe the identification is right to you. Thank you. That's perfect. So, I came to faith in Christ as a teenager because I then started talking about knowing Jesus as personal friend and savior. And I had the faintest idea what I meant. I really wanted it, so I prayed for it for about 9 months. And then it happened. And we were having your own family Hopkins for breakfast. And the first year of my Hopkins once said, I go to a dinner, I feel my finger and find Jesus. And this is really the thing upon me. And then, much later, I went to engineering, and after an engineering degree, I heard that the Russian astronaut, cosmonaut, they call it, had gone into space and had not been able to see God. And so I thought, well, maybe people studying the brain, or can they look into the brain, and find they haven't been able to find a soul. So maybe that's the place where there's been some Christians. So I went to do the doctorate with Donald Mackay in Kiel in England. And then I studied many different things. I focused on neuronal death, and I've been studying neuronal death in Lausanne, in Switzerland for the last 30 years. But at the moment, we're trying to find means of protection against stroke. But my subject is determinism and free will. So the problem, of course, is that the laws of nature are almost deterministic, which raises the question of, was the whole future of the universe determined at the moment of the Big Bang? What about miracles? What about answers to prayer? Now, I certainly believe in miracles, I certainly believe in answers to prayer, but I'm not going to deal with that today. I'm going to deal with this final question of free will. Can you have determinism and free will? So, there are many different kinds of determinism. Course, social scientists for a long time have been talking about social determinism. I'm a slave of my social environment. There's psychoanalytic determinism for those who believe in it. I'm a slave of my unconscious. There's genetic determinism. I'm a slave of my genes. But of course, there's influencing the environment as well. And I'm an identity twin. And my brother is very grateful for the fact that he's not identical to me in every way. Because the environment also plays a role. But supposing you could maintain the environment as unchangeable as well, what would happen then? There's a fish called Amazon Molly, which you can get isogenic offspring, so they're all absolutely identical genetically, and you can bring them up in an environment as identical as possible, and you still get changes, and in fact some quite major ones. For example, here's one you can see with the naked eye. When the axons grow from the eyes to the brain, in the optic nerve, sometimes in some animals they cross right over left, and others left over right. Because the occupiers, when the occupiers cross in fish, they cross completely, but there's this big difference. It makes no difference functionally, but at least anatomically, you can have this major difference. You can see with the naked eye, it's in the central nervous system, despite the fact that they're genetically identical and have an identical environment. Now, when axons grow, the nerve fibers, they are the wire back of neurons. They're sending out little filaments called filicolia, which seem to be testing the way. They're like these blind mole rats that can't see but touch to find where they're going to go. And it seems that the first axons come from the occupiers. They make an arbitrary decision to go right or left or left or the right. But supposing we can take account of everything else, every electron, and then get two systems that were absolutely identical, not just genetically, not just the external environment, but everything identical, would then everything be determined? And this you could call physical or Laplacian determinism, right of the brain. In which case, the problem of my brain is slave to the laws of physics.
And this is the problem I want to deal with today. Are we slaves to the laws of physics?
If our brains work mechanistically, then our behavior must be determined. So how can we be free? How can we be responsible for our choices if they were predetermined before we made them?
A few years ago, when my younger daughter was at a slightly rebellious age, and we still live her, she said, well, there are two possibilities. Either I'm behaving the way I behave for genetic reasons, in which case that's your fault, or it's the way I've been brought up, in which case it's your fault. How can we be responsible for our behavior if it was determined not by ourselves, but by the personal laws of physics and chemistry? Now, there are three main kinds of answers. There's hard determinism, which says that the past completely determines the future, including that of our own brains, so free will is an illusion. Some philosophers support this view. There's compatibilism, which agrees the determinism, that this is compatible with free will and human responsibility. So that is sometimes called soft determinism. You accept determinism, but it's okay. Then there's libertarianism, which says we do have free will, but this is incompatible with determinism, so determinism must be wrong. So these are the possibilities. Determinism is true, and we've got free will, then we're going to have compatibilism, which falls to the hard determinism. If determinism is incompatibilism combines these two. But there is a fourth possibility, which is called pessimistic incompatibilism, and the famous philosopher Galen Strawson advocates that determinism is incompatible with free will, and indeterminism is incompatible with free will, so basically bad luck. But I should do just the second and the third, which are the two that most Christians would want to support. So there are problems in the definition of free will. I'm strangled. I cannot understand what people mean by free will. I feel that I want to light my pipe, and I do it, but how can I connect this up with the idea of freedom? What is behind the act of willing to light the pipe? Another act of willing? There's considerable debate, of course, about the definition, as there always is in philosophy.
We love to debate definitions. But let's at least include the notion of responsibility
in the definition of free will.
And more precisely, here are two different definitions of free will. One is compatible with this definition, the power of making free choices unconstrained by external agents. I think that's ridiculous. Or a libertarian definition, the choices which are said to have no necessary determination from the nervous system or from any other physical cause. So it's not just external agencies that are concerned with a libertarian. So our choice of a libertarian or compatibilist approach may depend, not always, but in general will depend on our assumptions about the brain-mind relationship, if you're a dualist or a monist, as far as man is concerned. And dualists believe, of course it's complicated, there are many sorts of dualism. The interactive dualist believes there's a soul, meaning a numinal mind, or a pantheon, or a non-physical mind. This soul will act on the brain sheet, as of course Descartes believed, to these thoughts and actions. And in this case, we require some degree of indeterminism in the brain sheet, because otherwise the soul could not influence the brain sheet. But if you're a monist, it's terrible having a fancy motive of a fuck word, because I sort of feel that it's like a student talking to the professor in the front row. Everything I say about philosophy is wrong, but perhaps he will correct it later.
For Buddhism, you believe that the soul is actually embodied in the brain,
like the way that a program is instantiated in a computer. You don't say that the program is acting on the computer. That would be a strange way of talking. The soul is embodied in the brain, according to a Buddhist view. And in this case, we're probably going to think of a deterministic brain, a brain of a machine without loose screws. It would work better if there were no loose screws.
So these are the two basic approaches that most people adopt, one or the other.
Now, of course, the notion of dualism and soul, we're right back to Plato, before in fact, does not then mean that the body comes to exist by itself, separated from the soul, and that the soul exists by herself, separated from the body. So it's Socrates and Plato's view. And many Christians have adopted this Neoplatonist view of the soul, like Origen and Augustine, Luther and Calvin, Descartes, and Western philosophers. And by that I mean, if in the States or England or even continental Europe, you go and ask someone in Europe what they think, they will probably turn out to be some sort of jurist. So this is a very widely held view, and it's held also by a book called by Little Christ in Neurobiology, John Dickens, who wrote many books on the subject. But not all Christians hold this view. And one example of one given to us comes from Farrer, who was in Oxford in the 1950s when Eccles was also there. And Eccles had written a book proposing his dualistic views, and Farrer replied, "We will have nothing to do with the fantastic suggestion that what the supersensitive reactor in the cortex reacts to is the initiative of a virtually disembodied soul."
But that's an excellent theologian, highly respected, who was against dualism.
So both monism and dualism have a strong tradition in Christian philosophy. I would say that dualism has the strongest tradition of reference. But if you look at the use of words in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, where the word translated soul in the Old Testament is most commonly nefesh, which can mean creature, it has many meanings, but the usage is essentially monistic. In the New Testament, it's a bit more complicated. Theologians tend to believe, and these many theologians believe, that the use is really more monistic than dualistic in the New Testament as well, even though there's room for debate. And many modern Christian and non-Christian philosophers favor monism. And so I think we just have to take both views seriously, we'll give them consider both. Compatibilism associated with monism and libertarianism associated with dualism. Now, first, compatibilism, I'm only going to say very little about it, but I will insist that there is a difference between external constraint and internal constraint. If you say, "I smashed the window because my sister made me do it, she pushed me," that is at least rather different than someone who says, "I smashed the window because my brain made me do it." Because if my brain made me do it, then that's almost necessary to be responsible. If my brain didn't make me do it, then I wasn't responsible. So internal constraint is not the same as compulsion.
I'm not saying that the philosophical problem is solved. There's a tremendous debate among modern philosophers, for example, several books by Kane, supported libertarianism. There's still plenty of room for debate on the subject.
So libertarianism, which often has the idea of a soul acting on the brain machine, causing thoughts and actions. Now, this is going to require some kind of determinism for the soul to somehow interfere with the brain machine. And then it's going to require either the role of conservation in physics, which is continuous motion, conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, and so on. Or there's going to be some way in which this interaction can occur within the limits of physical determinism. Now, Descartes was already worried with this problem. He tried to find solutions, which we now think are not valid. But what I want to address is what is sometimes called quantum libertarianism, which is the idea that the influence of the soul and the brain occurs
by loading the quantum dice within the limits of quantum Heisenbergian uncertainty, which is really by most of the normal physicists, the fundamental limit of nuclear precision. And now we're getting to the heart. Now, I gave this talk in my department, where I worked at, because it would have been interesting to see how my colleagues reacted. And nobody said, oh, I'm against all this Christian rubbish. Not at all. But some of them did say, well, when you got onto quantum physics, it was a bit difficult. I would like to know, who here does know what Heisenbergian indeterminism is? So, roughly, maybe half or two thirds. Thank you. So, if you don't, it's going to be hard to know, but I will try to make it clear. And I'm going to use this as an excuse to speak in a fairly simple way that might not be the perfect way, but I'm also intimidated by the fact that there's a poppy form. So, it's not a simple thing. Now, basically, you know, photon. While the particle also has a wavelength, a frequency, it's like a wave. And according to modern wave mechanics, everything in fact has wave properties. And because of the wave properties, you can't define absolutely exactly what you could just say where the wave starts and where it finishes. There's a little bit of blur. And this blur is very, very small. And it's considered only to apply to very small particles, like photons or electrons. Beyond that side, it's negligible. But nevertheless, it exists. And basically, what one can derive from the wave equation is that there's an E relativity. In other words, the uncertainty in energy times the uncertainty in time has got to be greater than the very small value where H is Planck's constant. Or another version is that the P is momentum times the X, which is position. So it's not a limit on energy, it's not a limit on time, it's a limit on the product of the two. And if you're going to say that the time is perfectly defined, then you have no idea what the energy is. Otherwise you can have a bigger fault about both. So when I talk about this, physicists sometimes say to me, well, why bother to talk about that? This makes no sense at all. You can't get free will out of indeterminism. But what the quantum libertarians are saying is that they're not saying that it's just indeterminism, randomness, uncertainty is causing free will. What they're saying is that hidden in the fog of the indeterminism, there is something that is actually cause, that the soul is acting, an influence in determining. And this may seem strange to some physicists, most physicists don't like this idea. But really, if you read almost any book by a libertarian philosopher, you will find somewhere in the book the idea that, well, we've known for almost 100 years that determinism in physics is not true. So we're okay. But we're not really okay because we've got to deal with the fact that the indeterminism is very, very small. So, sorry, that's just what I had to say. Sorry, I'm wrong. Now, where in the brain would this mysterious influence act? And the only point I would make here is that if I decide to choose a copy, I might do that quite quickly. This indeterminism has got to be at the level of electroactivity of the brain. It's not going to be at the level of transcription, the level of making new RNA proteins. It's got to be something directly concerned with the electrical function of the brain. And people who support quantum determinism think that it's probably going to be somewhere in the working of the synapse. And I remind you, most of the people know all with it, this is a neuron, this is an output wire, the axon, and the burst of electricity, the action potential, will go down the wire, and when it gets to the end, it will cause calcium to go into the terminal, which will then cause many events, many elections to release the neurotransmitter influencing the next neuron. So if we look at higher magnification of this region, we've got these vesicles here, as you see in blue there, and some of them are a little bit away from the membrane, so some are close to it, and they're said to be docked, like a ship in a dock. They're held there,
and then they will fuse with the membranes, and then the molecules they contain, which are the transmitter molecules, will flow out, and they will find that the flow across this very tiny space, this very narrow space, to bind to receptors, the proteins, in the next membrane. And when they bind, they will open little gaps, little channels, in the next cell, which of course will be much more complicated than this gaps. And this will cause ions to flow in and out, and this will change the potential in the next cell. And here's a picture of one of the synaptic clefts. And here you can actually see the vesicles, and this one is fused in with the membrane. A remarkable picture. Now, when the vesicles bind, as I said, they're dark, they're held by proteins. There are several different proteins, because people spend their whole lives studying these proteins. We know a lot about them. And then when the potential in the terminal is changed by the arrival of an action potential, that will cause this voltage-dependent calcium channel to open, or voltage-dependent, of course, dependent on the voltage. And so when it's open, then the high concentration outside, the calcium outside, when it's open, the calcium will flow in. And it will find, to some extent, that this yellow protein, which is called synaptic aggregate. And this protein changes its shape when the calcium binds to it. And this will drag the vesicle close to the membrane and towards the release of the transmitter. So the sort of hypothesis that the quantum indeterminist proposed is that this, something in this event could be influenced by Heisenberg uncertainty. And I'm going to take the example that maybe something in the channel causing the calcium to entry could be influenced. There are other versions of this, but I think the arguments I'm going to give now would apply to other events as well. So I remind you that we've got the uncertainty in energy, and the uncertainty in time is greater than this very small number. And the time for this change would be, let's say, 10 microseconds. So if we say the time is very small, then we can allow a large uncertainty in energy, which would enable us to do lots of things with it. But the time is going to be fairly large. Normally when an action potential arrives in the terminal, then there's this transmitter and this going on for several hundred microseconds, almost a millisecond. So if we say that delta T is 10 microseconds, we're probably on the safe side. So let's do some calculation, assuming that delta T is 10 microseconds. And I think I'm not going to bore you too much with the detail, but if you do the calculation, you say the delta T is 10 microseconds and H is max, is Planck's number. Then you come with an uncertainty in an energy, which is about 5 times 10 to the minus 30 joules. So that's a very small number, a very small energy. And if you turn out that it's about 200 million times too small to affect the functioning of an ion channel by disrupting a single van der Waals interaction. There are several different forces of which the van der Waals interaction is the weakest. But even the weakest force is about 200,000 times larger than the uncertainty in energy that we have available. Now, the supporters of quantum indeterminism, quantum determinism, they support a slightly smaller value of gravity, maybe even 10 nanoseconds, which would be the permeation time for just a single ion to go through a channel. But even if we take that value, the uncertainty of energy is still about 200 times too small. So the basic message of this is that the uncertainty in energy that we can get from Heisenbergian uncertainty is too small to affect the functioning of the synapse. You can't get free will in that way. Now, I've read in some places, some people have said to me, but we already know that quantum effects can influence the nervous system. And indeed, people have shown by psychophysics and other means, by psychophysics, I mean just testing people's perception of light and so on, that a single word, in other words, more sensitive of the photoreceptors in the retina, can be influenced by a very few quantum of light, maybe only one. And if you do some calculations on that, you come to fact that the photon of light, or the light used for the experiment, is about 4×10⁻¹⁷ joules. So that is much, much greater than the delta E that I calculated before. So it's perfectly true that a photon of light can have influences on the nervous system. But that's because a photon of light is about 10^13 times more energetic than the uncertainty energy that we have to play with.
So if you do have a problem, the amount of energy available from Heisenbergian uncertainty is too small to have an effect.
Now, one thing that people say is no problem. Well, the world has changed to the discovery of chaos. I think that everybody here has heard about chaos. Extreme sensitivity to initial conditions, which will amplify even the smallest impermanence. We've got John Horton in the audience. I blame him a little bit of foul weather. And another thing to do with these equations invented by a meteorologist, a physicist studying weather, Lorentz, who became very famous for his Lorentz attractor. And so if you represent the state of the system by a particular position, then the system is changing by focusing around one of these photons, and the system can change from one to the other by very slight fluctuations, to extreme sensitivity to initial position. Now there are several problems to that. Firstly, it's not really sure if there is chaos in the brain that you're dealing with. Lots of people write papers about chaos in the brain, but it's actually quite difficult. Most people, they stick an electrode in the brain, they record a frame of action potential, they fish a computer program off the web, which enables them to fish out the answer, yes or no, chaos. And they say it's chaos. But actually, it's quite a difficult question. And it's very hard to be really sure of what's going on. But even if you can, there are other problems. And one is the so-called quantum suppression of chaos. The chaos theory and quantum theory are difficult to put together. And there are reasons for thinking that chaos, in many cases at least, will no longer be chaotic if you link it up with quantum theory. Just to speak in very loose terms, specialists would not like my loose way of talking now. But if you say that Heisenbergian uncertainty is like making something a bit foggy, then these lines must be infinitely thin in this same diagram will become a bit vague, which will mean that the lines will link onto themselves, which will mean that there's no longer chaos. Now the physicists will not like that way of saying, but they would agree that there is a problem linking quantum theory with chaos. And this is still a subject of debate. For the last few years, there have been arguments that the quantum suppression of chaos can itself be suppressed by another quantum effect due to interference in some circumstances. So my impression is that the debate is still open. But at least you can't just say, okay, no problem. Quantum indeterminism is small, but we're just amplified by chaos, and all is okay. No, it's a very difficult question, and we're far from clear. But even apart from that problem, there's another problem. Because cells have been in hot, wet surroundings, and the molecules make it a constant in random movement because of their thermal energy. And you can calculate the thermal energy of molecules. For example, in the cell, and it comes to something like 6.4×10⁻¹ joules, which is enormous compared to the uncertainty we were calculating before, about 1,000 million times greater. So if you really say that the cell is sensitive to the high energy uncertainty that we've got from uncertainty in potential energy, then you've got a problem that it's got to be also sensitive to this enormous energy that's 10^9 times greater. And in fact, cells are built to be resistant to the fluctuation of thermal energy. You've got visible bouncing around in the cell. You've got suddenly something 10^9 times more is going to have an effect. It's not
is it a belief?
Pardon? Okay, fine.
So I will agree on today that I am made a belief.
Now, even most quantum libertarians don't actually do many calculations. But one who has done is Beck, who collaborated with John Eccles. And the only message I want to get from this, without going into the details for the short time, is that he came to basically the same conclusion. But what he did then was to say, okay, we've got to have a very short delta t. If delta t is small, then we're going to have an enormous delta t, and the problem is solved. So he concluded, we've got to get new apparatus to search in the brain for events that depend on the time scales of about 1.3 picoseconds, 10 to the minus 12 seconds. So, I think no of you are right to believe that there are events working at that sort of time scale. Now, there are two other problems. There's a million of these fluctuations in quantified by chaos. We're probably not the choice, it's chaos, right? And then also, let's remember that some of this is still intersect that Heisenbergian uncertainties are fundamental to the nature of knowledge. So there are lots of problems there. So in conclusion, the philosophical debate about determinism of materials is far from being resolved. We find both excellent philosophers on both sides. Most of the Christian philosophers are either compatibilists or libertarians. They're finding and the almost deterministic nature of physical interaction raises problems for libertarians. And quantum uncertainty doesn't encourage machines to provide a sound basis for defending the libertarian position. Thank you.
Determinism, mainly 7 minutes for yes.
Thanks. I have a general problem with respect to the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. As far as I understand, this is only question of observation. This doesn't apply to the underlying process. This just tells us something about how precise we can measure things, either energy or time or pulse or location. So it doesn't tell us anything about whether a process is determined or not. I mean, this is related to the collapse of the wave function. So applying that to the whole area of whether there can be determinism somewhere doesn't make any sense in my understanding.
Okay, so you're basically supporting my conclusion at least.
I think it doesn't relate to that. It just tells us something about observation of physical processes, how accurate we can know that. And it's a thing that arises, as far as I understand, in the act of observation, because there the wave functions and that level collapse, either if we decide to do it at the energy or yeah. Time and things like that. It doesn't tell us anything about the question of
that. This is a question of debate among physicists. From my understanding, that most physicists think that it is not just a problem of observation, it is a fundamental problem of nature. So some physicists would agree with you. Well, the original, well, on Einstein was on your side, so. Okay, well, so then maybe for the third, there's a certainly a
family there. I thought
there
was a.
As we know, we are constantly bombarded by cosmic rays. So, any other cosmic ray, or even a neutrino, is part of the physical electron state of our brain. So why do we need to invoke uncertainty theory? Actually, in reality, there's a lot of uncertainty just from the environment.
Okay, well that's a good point. I mean, that will be yet another problem with Heisenbergian, using Heisenbergian uncertainty for quantitative theories. Although, I mean, if you're going to say that, no, I'm not going to give up. I agree with you, but I can see some argument I'm giving against.
Any more uncertain questions?
I'm considering looking at the property down the relationship because you're looking at
even though I'm not inside the quantum vegetarianism, I've tried to see a way in which you could use that, and I haven't found one.
Time for one more? Okay, two more. There's one there, and then again. Go ahead.
Within the context of compatibilism, can you comment on monism versus dualism as a relation to free will?
Okay, well, I'm not finished. I mean, I've already said that on the whole, monists tend to be compatibilists and dualists tend to be libertarians. But I know there are some exceptions. But I'm not really sure what the question is.
Does the monist or dualist point of view favor free will more than the other?
Well, I mean, though on most sides they would say that decision is compatible with free will. Now, a lot of people disagree, but I mean, since Galen and Scotton thinks that all possibilities are against free will, I can't give a clear answer. I mean, if you force me, if you torture me to decide on one particular view, I would go for a monistic anthropology, and I would go for compatibilist philosophy of free will, but with great caution.
Yes, final question.
Yeah, just to say, obviously there are in-between positions. You don't have to believe in some kind of crude external soul to be a kind of dualist libertarian, but also your talk had a lot of kind of uncertainty in it, well, it looks as though it is, and so on. I just wonder, you mentioned at the beginning the idea of Laplacian determinism, where everything is kind of predetermined from the Big Bang. It seemed to be that that's practically what you're adopting, but if it's something like that, then you didn't address at all the problem of theodicy, which is why would God make the world, which was pre-programmed to run completely in this way, even if we have compatibilist free will and mental responsibility. With all the kind of horrors of what's going on in the world, we didn't even address that question, which many libertarian free willers would see as the fundamental question.
Look, I agree. Firstly, I do believe in answered prayer, I do believe in miracles, I do believe that God intervenes in history by the coming of Jesus Christ, but also by answered prayer and other things even today. So I'm not a pure Laplacian. But on the question of theodicy, I recommend your books, which are excellent. Even though I didn't have time to deal with that today. Books by Roger Foster and Paul Marston, which are very well known in England.
Thank you very much.